The first case of the morning is 012844, the Sierra Club versus the EPA. And good morning. Mr. Williams, can't make a mistake this morning, can I?
May it please the court, my name is Doug Williams and I represent the petitioners in this case, Sierra Club and Missouri Coalition for the Environment. This case comes, actually, as consolidated petitions for review of two EPA rulemakings. Comes before the court against the background of extensive litigation, somewhat complex procedurally speaking, and raising a number of issues. This morning I would like to direct my argument to what we believe is the principal issue in the case, and that is whether, despite the absence of any statutory authority, EPA may override or ignore the reclassification provisions applicable to the St. Louis ozone non-attainment area and grant an 8-year extension of St. Louis's attainment deadline simply because the area is affected by pollution from other states. In addressing this question, I think we should begin with the language of the statute. In the Engine Manufacturers Association case cited in EPA's brief at page 19, the court there said, the plain meaning of legislation should be conclusive, except in the rare cases in which the literal application of a statute will produce a result demonstrably at odds with the intentions of its drafters.
But isn't that precisely what both the EPA and the joint interveners respondent states are arguing, that if you look at the statute as a whole, the idea was to impose restrictions that would attain these various goals, and if it's all blowing in from Kentucky, or in the case of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, it's all blowing in from Houston, you'll spend a lot of money for exactly zero results. Why would Congress want that?
Well, I think that is indeed their argument. The idea that spending all this money will achieve zero results is not one with which we agree. The consequence of setting aside this rule would be that the St. Louis area would be reclassified to a serious area, and that would require additional pollution controls.
Would it receive a result faster than 2004?
Well, that's sort of an open question, but part of the reason why we're at this late date is simply because we've been battling with EPA now for 4 years. I don't think the course of the litigation ought to determine the principle of law that's applicable here. I mean, EPA has managed to delay resolution of this issue for 4 years.
You argue that there are health benefits to these local restrictions that St. Louis would be required to implement if it was reclassified. EPA claims there are no benefits. How are we supposed to resolve this factual dispute?
I don't think you need to resolve that factual dispute. Of course, it might bear on the interpretation of whether the statute makes any sense as written, but EPA has no real evidence to show that the control measures required of a serious area would produce no health benefits. Even the states admit in their intervener's brief that no modeling was done on these additional controls. So the confidence with which EPA can say there's no health benefits is misplaced. And the other thing I would say, it's not entirely correct to say EPA is saying there are no health benefits. What it's saying is it will not advance the date on which the area achieves attainment. Those are not the same issues.
Could I just clarify, because you stressed that, and they logically might not be the same issue. If the attainment is up here, is your argument that you'll at least get this far faster, or that somehow in these intermediate levels, it's not that it's not like flipping a switch, of course, and one day you have attainment?
Well, that's right. I think what the additional controls would do would reduce the frequency of exceedances in the area, and also reduced peak ozone concentrations. If you look at the American trucking case and its history, which involves EPA's attempt to revise the ozone standard, it becomes quite clear that the health effects of ozone depend to a considerable degree on the concentration to which a person is exposed. There's not a point at which, you know, you can determine that this level has effects and below which it has none.
But the EPA seems to think local controls would be futile. And again, I how do we resolve this dispute, which is factual?
Well, I think we look to the language of the statute. I don't think we need to resolve that dispute. EPA's authority rests on the proposition that had Congress contemplated what was going on here, it would have granted EPA the authority it now claims.
So your real argument is simply that since it's not in the statute, and lots of other mechanisms are in the statute that recognize the problem of ozone transfer, that EPA, just as a statutory matter, doesn't have the authority to use this mechanism to adjust the system. Is that right?
Well, that's absolutely right. That's our argument in a nutshell. EPA can point to nothing approaching anything that represents textual authority for its policy in this case. Its claim is that Congress expected all interstate ozone problems to be solved in time for all areas to achieve the ozone standard by their attainment date. And Congress was dramatically wrong in that assumption. And that is the basis for EPA's attempt to simply override a number of provisions in the very specific provisions applicable to ozone non-attainment areas.
Well, you know, you argue that Chevron deference isn't applicable here because Congress explicitly and expressly address this situation. Exactly where did Congress address it? Here's my problem. You seem to rely more on statutes that address closely related or closely analogous situations, but not exactly this one.
Well, I think the most explicit address Congress made to this issue is in Section 181A5 when it provided for extensions of attainment dates. And the Supreme Court looked at the language of the statute, compared it with language elsewhere in the Clean Air Act, and said one of the principal things that Congress did in these special ozone non-attainment provisions was to impose strict limits on EPA discretion. And more specifically, in making that comparison, it expressly said, the Supreme Court said, EPA may grant no more than 2 years extension. And I think, you know, when we look at this language, that conclusion necessarily follows. Now, EPA wants to override this natural and most straightforward reading of the statute on this theory that had Congress really known, but the statute, I think, makes clear that Congress did not harbor the assumption that EPA claims it did. That is, that this ozone transport problem would be completely solved or solved in a way that would eliminate any problems for areas like St. Louis. And we cite Section 185E of the statute in our reply brief, and I think this provision makes clear that Congress did think about this issue. It decided the circumstances in which it was going to address this issue, and it did not make provision for the kind of circumstances that EPA claims now. 185E relates to extreme and serious errors. What it says is, if those areas fail to attain because of interstate transport of pollutants, they are not subject to the penalties associated with failure to attain. The attainment dates for those two classifications are, respectively, 2005, 2010. In our view, it's completely implausible to argue that Congress believed, given that provision, that this transport problem would be solved by 1996. And to sort of put this in a different perspective, one of the things that is in the Act are remedies for states to cure interstate ozone pollution. The 126 provisions, the SIP call provisions that EPA has utilized. Now, one of the ways of characterizing the issue is where does the risk that those provisions, the provisions that allow for remedies, in the event they prove to be not entirely workable, who should bear the risk of that unworkability? Should it be the breathers or should it be the polluters? And I think Congress's answer was clear. And notice, too, that the exceptions Congress made for rural transport areas in 182H and for these extreme and serious areas, or severe areas, excuse me, are limited to very small population areas. It said perhaps the number of affected citizens isn't sufficiently great that we think extensive control measures would be appropriate. But in large metropolitan areas, I think Congress can make a considered judgment that the risk of the failure of these provisions for providing remedies for interstate ozone transport ought to fall on the polluting sources and not on the breathers.
What effect, if any, does the April 5th ruling in Sierra Club versus Whitman have here?
The April 5th ruling? I don't think it has much bearing on this case at all. I mean, all it says is they're affirming the district court's refusal to enforce compliance. We had argued before the district court that EPA's rulemakings that are under review here were inconsistent with the order that the district court had previously ordered. And the district court's answer was, all I can do is look at what EPA did in response to the order and not the collateral rulemakings because jurisdiction over those rulemakings comes before this court. Now, I don't think it has any bearing at all on the issue of the legality of the extension policy. It does, the district court litigation bears on this case in an important way, and that is the district court said EPA may not delay making this determination, which automatically results in reclassification, for the reasons EPA invoked in the rulemaking, and that is to delay so they could consider whether St. Louis was entitled to an extension of its attainment date under this extension policy. Nothing in the Court of Appeals decision in the D.C. Circuit case disturbed that conclusion. And indeed, EPA didn't even appeal that issue. We think it's bound by that. So in granting this extension of the effective date, it says, of the determination, we think EPA ran afoul of the district court's conclusion.
But that's the issue that's before us, right? Whether in fact
right.
there's the authority to do that, which the D.C. Circuit acknowledges in the last paragraph of its opinion. They say, as to the merits, go to the other Court of Appeals.
Well, we think specifically, yes, the one of the issues before the court is whether any collateral estoppel effects should be given to the district court's conclusion, and we think it should. I mean,
but if the district court was just making a jurisdictional ruling, I read the district court's opinion in D.C. as saying, this is how much is in front of me. I have jurisdiction to talk about telling EPA to take these ministerial steps. EPA has now done it. I'm finished. And if it's only, say, if it's carving out a jurisdictional area, I don't see how that affects things that are outside of that zone.
Well, I just think it depends on how we characterize the issue in the district court litigation. We argue that EPA had a non-discretionary duty to make this determination by a particular date. EPA comes in response and says, yes, we do, but we want the court to exercise its equitable discretion and allow us to delay making the determination. Why? Because of interstate transport and the downwind and extension policy. EPA, when it complied with the district court's order to the extent of actually making a formal determination. Now, I should say this. Whether EPA, in fact, did what the district court ordered, I think, remains somewhat of an open question. The district court didn't really address this point, but it ordered EPA to make a final determination, and EPA, in one of the rulemakings under review here, says it hasn't made a final determination. But the issue in the district court case was simply this. Can EPA delay making this determination because of this policy? In one of the rulemakings under review here, the one we refer to in our brief as the May 16th rule, EPA invoked that same reason to delay making the determination effective. And we think that's the same issue that was litigated before the district court. The district court, you know, made a clear decision on that. It was essential to her judgment, and there can be no contention that EPA wasn't adequately represented before the district court. So I think, you know, all the requirements of collateral estoppel attain here.
Can you just tell me about the practical consequences of this reclassification in terms of money and net benefit result at the end of it?
I can't speak to the cost issue because I simply don't know. But I can tell you the end result. If you want to be really practical about it, the D.C. Circuit has now affirmed EPA's new ozone rule, which lowers the ozone permissible ozone concentration to 8 parts per million. In our view, the additional controls required of a serious error are going to have to be implemented at some point to reach this new standard once it goes into effect. So if you want to be completely pragmatic about it, the question is simply when. And we think that there's authority and indeed requirement in the Act that they be implemented now, or at least on a timetable that makes sense. I see I'm running into my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Williams.
Morning, Judge. Morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Williams. I'm counsel from the Department of Justice representing EPA. With me at counsel table is Bob Patrick, counsel from EPA, Ben Goldgar, counsel from Illinois, and Jeffrey Fort, counsel from the industry interveners. The issue I'd like to focus on first, if I may, are the unusual circumstances posed by this case and the practical consequences of petitioner's arguments.
Mr. Williams, before you do that, let me just put on the table for you, for however you wish to incorporate this into what you say, my biggest concern with your position. This, of course, is an environmental case, but this court sees lots of different kinds of cases. And when I hear the Department of Justice taking the position, although we can't find any authority in a statute for what we did, the broader policies that Congress must have had in mind justify what we did anyway, and had they only known, they would have done something different, I wonder what's the limiting principle to that. I think, for instance, of the welfare reform law that was passed in 1996, where there were assumptions made about how readily people could move from welfare to work, and there was a very rigid cutoff of when people would no longer be eligible. And, of course, the economy has its ups and downs, and September 11th happens, and different things happen that Congress surely didn't foresee. So I think, well, maybe that deadline doesn't work either. And how many other deadlines? Sometimes statutes are written more rigidly than they perhaps should have been, but it strikes me the remedy is to go back to Congress, which is more or less what the Supreme Court said in TVA against Hill, but there have been long discussions among members of the Supreme Court about how one deals with statutes. And I don't know however sensible your arguments may be, you know, however foolish Congress may have been in thinking that this was going to be the right system, I don't know how we have the authority to say, well, we're just going to jettison it and put in something that makes more sense because we know better this time.
And I'm going to double team you because you seem to concede that a literal application of the law would not have allowed the EPA to do what it did. Bottom line, why isn't that the end of the case? We don't legislate here.
I'll obviously address your concerns first, Judge. Judges, EPA does not take the position that anytime it believes it may enact regulations that it believes are most appropriate, it can bootstrap its authority to do so, to take that action. That is not the argument we're putting forward in this case. Instead, we believe we have shown that this case is one of those rare circumstances in which Congress did not anticipate the problems faced by non-attainment areas such as St. Louis.
So why don't you go back to Congress? I mean, I'm thinking I would be shocked to hear Attorney General Ashcroft come in and talk about a race discrimination case like this, a welfare case like this, principles are principles, and they cut in different ways, in different factual circumstances. But Congress, in fact, I mean, this is sort of a secondary response to what you're saying, has all manner of provisions in the statute about ozone transport, about extensions of time, about remedies that states have if they think they're being adversely affected by upwind sources. So it's pretty hard to make the case that Congress is oblivious to this. And even if it shows, as I say, maybe I'm not going to take issue with whether EPA correctly decided that the system is foolish. Maybe it is. But what can we do?
Judge, I think that there is authority, and we cited the NRDC case from the D.C. Circuit, in which, in that case, states faced a Clean Air Act deadline that they could not meet because of circumstances beyond their control.
Because EPA had delayed until it was 9 days before the deadline, and the court said, the court had two conflicting statutory mandates that it had to reconcile in that case.
Judge, I believe you're talking about the deadlines with respect to the enhanced inspection modification program. In addition, there were deadlines with respect to SIP revisions related to the RACT controls that were required. And the states could not meet those deadlines because the modeling was not ready in time to permit the states to make the showing required under the statute to seek an exemption from those controls. So,
is this an argument you would want to make to Justice Scalia?
We'd be happy to make it anywhere.
I hope so.
I'd like to highlight what we believe are the important practical considerations here. Petitioners seek the reinstatement of the March 19th non-attainment determination, which set the same 2004 attainment date included in the June 26th rule challenged by the petitioners. Under the March 19th non-attainment determination, St. Louis would be reclassified as a serious non-attainment area, even though its air quality, in fact, continues to improve. Under the June 26th rule, St. Louis would maintain its classification as a moderate non-attainment area. That's the only difference between the June 26th rule promulgated by EPA and the March 19th non-attainment determination sought by petitioners is not the attainment date, but the local controls that will be imposed on St. Louis.
But you know, I have another practical question about this. Everyone is talking about 2004 as though this is, you know, the new millennium, you know, the date at which, you know, Kentucky will be perfect and, you know, the world will sort itself out. As you yourself have stressed through your brief, that would be a shift in the history of this effort to control ozone. For all I know, Kentucky will have difficulty controlling its own situation by that time. There might be slippage of 2004. There certainly has been plenty of slippage elsewhere along the way, and part of this reclassification system was to address that problem, to say, okay, you know, we are going to do as much as possible along the way, and if you miss one date, we're going to give you more time, but we're going to ratchet up the things you need to do.
I have two responses to that, Judge. Number one, the NOx SIP call and the 126th rule, to which Kentucky is also subject, represent a sea change in EPA's approach to the problem of transported pollution. So it's not just another year in business as usual. The NOx SIP call, in particular, represents an enormous effort to control this enormous and difficult problem. And while it may be that unforeseen difficulties in compliance with the SIP call arise, it cannot be characterized as merely another step in the process. The NOx SIP call is enormously complex and represents a concerted effort by EPA and numerous stakeholders to address the indisputable problem of transported pollution. The second point I want to make in response, Judge, is that even if St. Louis is bumped up to a serious area, it will not attain the ozone max any earlier than 2004.
Is it your argument that it will remain absolutely stable, or that the incremental improvements simply won't be enough to achieve attainment on its own without the contribution of other states?
Judge, we do not maintain that St. Louis will not experience any improvement in air quality. That's not a position we take. However, the whole point of the ozone standards, the SIP process, the attainment date, and the classification process is the attainment of the ozone standard. That's the focus throughout Title I of the Clean Air Act, and that's the focus of all the state's activities. And so when St. Louis will not attain the ozone standard any earlier under a serious reclassification, under reclassification as a serious area, that demonstrates the futility of a bump up. And the costs are significant. Details in the state's brief and the industry intervener's brief.
But you're defining it's futile non-attainment as opposed to improvement, but not, you know, some improvement equals futile in your mind.
The focus of Title I of the Clean Air Act is attainment of the ozone standard. And when St. Louis will not attain the ozone standard, and I want to emphasize that St. Louis is close to attainment now.
Right,
so if St. Louis is very close to attainment now, but still will not attain, how significant are the marginal improvements between now and only 2 years from now?
That's a factual dispute, isn't it?
Judge, I don't think it's not a factual dispute that St. Louis will not attain any earlier than 2004, even under a serious reclassification. The petitioners have conceded that point on page 14 of their reply brief.
Yes, but let's, you know, look at the ramifications. Kind of the same question I asked Mr.
Douglas Williams.
You know, you argue there are no health benefits to the reclassification. He argues there are. You argue about whether local controls alone could help St. Louis achieve attainment even with the ozone transport problem. He argues the opposite. So, I mean, you know, you think local controls would be futile. So,
Judge, I'd like to correct that misimpression, if I may. We do not argue that there will be no improvement in air quality with the additional local controls resulting from a serious reclassification. We do not make that argument. We do argue that St. Louis will not attain any earlier than the 2004 attainment date. That's a proposition that petitioners have conceded. That's on page 14 of the reply brief. So I think that there is no factual dispute here. The parties are in agreement on those two points.
So could, oh, sorry.
Mr. Williams, Doug Williams, said he was uncertain about the cost would be here, what we're talking about. What is it? Do you know?
The record does not contain any information about costs. However, clear that as the
cost is one of the things driving the EPA's decision.
Well, certainly the burden of imposing responsibility for upwind pollution on the St. Louis area is an important consideration, and that is based in large part on costs, on the unfairness of causing St. Louis to incur those costs on imposing the additional local controls for a serious area, when those controls will not advance attainment, and when those controls are imposed because of upwind pollution that St. Louis, Missouri, and Illinois cannot control. So certainly, cost and the unfairness of imposing those costs on St. Louis are an important consideration behind the transport-based extension policy.
But we have no idea knowing about what those costs are.
Well, we do not have dollar figures in the record that indicate what those costs are. So I would concede that point. However, the industry brief says that hundreds of sources will be newly subject to permitting requirements under the Clean Air Act. And as a legal matter, certainly, smaller sources become subject to the stringent permitting and emissions control requirements in the Clean Air Act. The industry brief has identified literally hundreds, that there are literally hundreds of sources that will be newly subject to these costly controls. So certainly the expenses, the costs associated with the bump up are significant.
Could I ask you a question? This may be a bit out of left field, but how, if at all, does this newly upheld revised 8-hour ozone rule interact with the subject matter of this case?
I think not at all, Your Honor. The Supreme Court, the D.C. Circuit recently upheld the new standard.
Right, that's what I'm referring to.
The Supreme Court had struck down EPA's implementation approach. And so EPA right now is deciding how to respond to the Supreme Court's striking down the implementation scheme.
But there is now going to be, at least at some point, as soon as EPA figures out how to do it, an 8-hour rule, right?
Yes. For your information, the previous EPA approach had been that it would apply the new 8-hour standard only to areas that had attained the 1-hour standard. So the 1-hour standard would apply until an area attained. Now, I don't know if EPA is going to do that.
Sure, no,
but to the extent that that approach continues, then it's going to, if the 1-hour standard would apply to non-attainment areas. So it's important to emphasize that under Sierra Club's view of the Clean Air Act, even though more stringent local controls will not accelerate St. Louis's attainment of the ozone standard, EPA is nevertheless required to impose them on St. Louis. And that, in a nutshell, is what this case is about. EPA believes this interpretation of the statute is illogical, unwarranted, and inequitable. And we believe this court should look to the NRDC case for authority for the extension of a state's Clean Air Act deadline when it cannot meet that deadline because of circumstances beyond its control. We believe that Congress, in the Clean Air Act, and particularly in the 1990 amendments, and in particular sections 110A2D and section 126, made clear that it intended to put the burden of eliminating pollution on those areas where the pollution originates and not on the areas that are impacted by that pollution. Congress, however, did not anticipate that when it revised the Act in 1990, that a downwind moderate non-attainment area, which had 6 years to attain the ozone standard, would still be victimized by transported pollution, and that the controls necessary to permit those downwind areas to reach attainment would not take effect for 14 years after the 1990 amendments because of the difficulty in understanding, modeling, and formulating a regulatory response to the transported pollution problem. Thus, there's a gap in the statute that EPA has attempted to fill, and EPA's transport-based extension policy is based on the textual commitment of Congress to equitably allocating the burdens of pollution control to those areas that generate the pollution, not those areas that are victimized by it. Are there no more questions?
Thank you, Mr. Hume. Thank you.
Thank you. In response to the other Mr. Williams' argument,
maybe we should move to a first name basis.
Okay, maybe that would ease things. And as far as I know, there's no relation between us, but who knows? The Williamses go way back. Anyway, one thing I would like to respond to that Scott made is he said the whole point of the Clean Air Act was to achieve attainment. Well, perhaps that's one way to characterize it, but I think the overriding point is the purpose of this statute is to protect public health. Any improvement in the protection of public health we can make that is dictated by the strict terms of the statute, I think we ought to be forcing EPA to do, forcing the state to do. That's the point of this statute. It's a public health protection. And EPA now has conceded to this court that the controls that we want implemented in St. Louis and we feel are mandated by the Clean Air Act would in fact yield health benefits. Getting back to Judge Robner's point, I agree with Scott Williams that there is no longer a factual dispute in this case. A couple of other points. One of the themes that's consistently advanced here is this notion of inequity, that it's unfair to impose upon St. Louis requirements to control local sources of pollution when part of the problem is due to out-of-state sources. Well, I think we responded to this in our brief, but I want to sort of emphasize it here. Lots of areas were initially classified as serious areas in 1990. That classification was based solely on measured ozone concentration. It did not make any differentiation between where that pollution came from, whether it came from local sources, out-of-state sources. Those areas have no avenue of relief from the serious requirements, even if the contribution made from out-of-state sources is greater than the contribution made from out-of-state sources in St. Louis. I don't see any equity in EPA's position. In fact, I see it as being inequitable to the states that have already been classified, taking into consideration transported ozone from other regions. EPA says, well, you know, Congress had to do this quickly. Well, it could have provided a remedy, as we pointed out in our brief. It could say, you know, reclassification could work both ways. If you can show that out-of-state pollution is contributing to your problem, come on in and we'll rearrange your classification to better account for the responsibility of local sources. EPA, in fact, did provide something of that in a couple of provisions of the Act, the rural transport provision in particular. It holds those areas only to the requirements for marginal areas, regardless of what the actual state of air quality is. In sum, I can see I'm out of time. I think, you know, Judge Wood's concern is precise, and Judge Robner's concern is precisely the concern that we have. Where does this end? Every time EPA has a better mousetrap, at least thinks it has a better mousetrap, can it suddenly create a gap in a statute and say, the statute no longer works, so we're going to implement our mousetrap? I don't think that's what the administrative law system is about. I don't think it's what our democratic form of government is about. Thank you.
Thanks to both the Mr. Williams for folks and all the parties for well-argued briefs and a well-argued argument. And the case will be taken under advisement.